As we're going through some of the villages, I could see that someone had spent a lot of time making the baskets that they use to process rice, much like the way we do at home, the way we winnow the rice. And I could see that someone had spent a lot of time, and we just go through and trash it or burn it. We were there as Marines. We were there to kill people, and that's what we did. Our motto was, if it moved, shoot it. If it doesn't, burn it. It's what we did. We were the bayonet end of America's foreign policy, and we killed and got killed. Jim Northrup, a veteran of the Vietnam War, and Anishinaabe from the Fond du Lac Reservation in Minnesota, is one of thousands of Native Americans who served in the armed forces of the United States. How do the experiences of Native Americans in the military differ from those of other soldiers? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Air.
How did the image of the warrior affect the experiences of Native American soldiers during the World Wars? Why were Native Americans integrated into the military at a time when blacks were not? And why would Native Americans, many of whom weren't even U.S. citizens, want to fight in the U.S. military? Our guest is Patty Lowe, professor in the Department of Life Sciences Communication at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and producer of documentaries for Wisconsin Public Television. Her most recent documentary is Way of the Warrior, broadcast on PBS stations around the country in November of 2007.
And welcome back to University of the Air.
Thank you, Emily. Hi, Norman.
With this project, the one that looks at Native warriors and their role in the American military, what prompted you to undertake this?
Well, really, it began with my grandfather. He was one of 12,000 Native Americans who volunteered for World War I, and I always thought that was really ironic. I imagined him standing up with his hand upraised, taking that oath to defend the Constitution, as all military recruits do, and thinking he had no protections under the Constitution. He wasn't a citizen, nor were most of the other 12,000 American Indians. And that percolated for about 20 years, and I collected stories. I talked to veterans at powwows, and I asked them why they enlisted, because the vast majority enlisted. They weren't drafted. They volunteered. And I wanted to know why, because, you know, the history of Native people with the U.S. government is pretty uneven. And the responses I got were not the responses I expected. I volunteered because of economic reasons or because, you know, my life didn't have a lot of opportunities on the reservations. They were talking. In fact, one veteran in Chicago told me that his tribe had signed a peace and friendship treaty with the U.S. government in 1827, in which they promised to come to the military assistance of the U.S. should it ever need it. And even though the U.S. government had broken every treaty it ever signed with his tribe, his people, he told me, were still honoring their obligations. So I knew that there was something unique there. I knew that there were some great stories. And a couple of years ago, I was able to acquire some grants and began work on it.
Did you see any tribal patterns among the veterans that you talked to?
Absolutely. And that was one of the clearest motivations for a lot of the Native American soldiers I talked to. Their tribes had warrior traditions. They had active warrior societies. The only way you could gain entrance to those societies was through combat. And because that was a rite of passage that really wasn't available to them in a cultural sense, the only opportunity for that was through the U.S. military.
And I noticed that your grandfather seemed to come into play in this film more than you even expected. Tell us about his tribal affiliation, something about his background and his own story.
Well, he was a Bad River tribal member, born on the Keweenaw Bay Reservation where his mother grew up. And like many Native children of the era, was sent away to a government boarding school where life was very militaristic. He drilled with a little wooden rifle in a cadet uniform. He marched to dormitories. He marched to his classes. He marched to the dining hall, as did all the other children in that school. And so he was really, you know, ripe for picking. And one of the historians in my documentary described it as, you know, this seamless transition from the boarding schools to the training camps to the front lines. So he was recruited out of an Indian boarding school. He joined the National Guard. His guard unit was mobilized during the Mexican border wars against Pancho Villa. And they were really the only combat-ready troops, these guard troops, many of them from Indian boarding schools around the country. His guard unit was rolled into the 32nd Red Arrow Division and sent to France in the first wave of the American Expeditionary Forces. His unit fought in all seven major battles in which the U.S. participated, and he was gassed, lost part of a lung to a mustard gas attack. He suffered shrapnel wounds, never filed any papers to, you know, get any kind of military assistance. And in that sense was also pretty typical of Native Americans. They just didn't do that, didn't really know how to navigate it, probably wouldn't have done it anyway. Came back, moved to Milwaukee, and really didn't teach his children the language. And in this way, too, he was very typical of Native Americans of his generation because there was so much discrimination in his own mind, he said later, it was a way to protect his family. So I never intended to have this documentary get genealogical, but, you know, there were just these serendipitous, strange things that kept happening. Somebody would give me photographs that he took along the Mexican border. Someone else gave me an audio tape of an interview that was done with him. And then a cousin gave me his diary that no one in the family in Wisconsin knew existed. And at that point, I finally gave in and thought, well, you know, there's been this unseen hand on my shoulder, you know, presumably my grandfather saying, I want to be in this documentary. So I finally said, you know, he's every man. You know, his experience really is typical of what Native soldiers went through during World War I, so why not tell his story?
And he was in an infantry unit?
He was in the 127th Infantry Unit, and his unit was a unit that the military brass, according to the author of American Indians in World War I, Tom Britton, his unit was one of those that the military actually contemplated putting Plains Indian war bonnets on and, you know, and outfitting them with face paint.
I guess the Germans were afraid of Indians.
They were. They were really terrified. You know, they'd grown up on Karl May novels, and Karl May was sort of the Louis L'Amour of Germany of his era. And so the German soldiers were terrified that they were going to get scalped because of these 40 novels that they'd read by Karl May. It never happened, but it was clear that Native American troops were used as shock troops in the front lines.
So they were in some ways, although they were in some ways, I guess, integrated into the troops, they were also highlighted in some ways.
They were. They wound up in the most dangerous assignments, you know, because of these stereotypes that somehow they could see in the dark and they had better hearing and a better sense of direction. And, you know, military commanders bought into the whole leather stocking, you know, James Fenimore Cooper mystique that, you know, Indians could somehow speak volumes from a single blade of bent grass. And so they were put into these dangerous positions, and because of that, their casualty rate in World War I was 5 times higher than that of the regular AEF. And there are consequences to stereotypes, you know, in World War I, but all the way through the wars of the 20th century, right up to Vietnam, where Native soldiers are still scouting, they're still being used to shock troops, they're still having higher casualty rates, and they're also coming home with higher incidences of PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder,
which they don't
because
seek
they're
help
seeing
for.
The horror of war close up. And they are the group that is least likely to seek benefits, health benefits, education benefits, housing benefits. And this is just the nature of their experience.
And why are they not bitter then? Or maybe they were. Tell me about your grandfather and what you know about his emotions after he came home.
You know, in this audio interview, he talks about wanting to do his part. And my mother, who served in the defense industry during World War II, also talks about doing her part. My grandfather was very patriotic. You know, my uncles tell me that he loved to go to parades, and he went to all the parades of the 20s and 30s that were staged in Milwaukee for veterans of World War I. He, you know, always saluted, took off his hat. You know, there was this layer of American patriotism and nationalism that was there on top of his own Native experience as well.
But was he aware of the extra high casualty rate, the use of Native soldiers in more dangerous positions?
I don't think he was. And, you know, that's the kind of overarching sort of perspective you only gain with time.
And if one of the stereotypes is the sort of Indian scout that can, you know, see in the dark and all that, another one is probably the stoic Indian that can take anything and won't measure emotion, won't weep and so on. Do you think that played a role in how they were seen, that they would somehow be able to take the horrors of war and not—
Because they're good at it. They're super warriors. They're bloodthirsty. It's in their blood. Yeah.
And then they will not cry about it later.
Right. And those stereotypes are very clear in some of the documents, the assessments that white military commanders did after the war about how their Native boys performed. And they do sort of convey this super warrior status onto their men. And they also talk about their bloodthirstiness. And what they are describing in these charges that Native Americans are leading are these savage whoops and war cries and animal sounds. And, you know, what's really interesting to me as I've explored this warrior tradition is what they're witnessing and what they're not seeing is Native soldiers invoking their clan, their totems, their clan figures. And in World War I, most of the Native soldiers are carrying medicine bundles with them. They're wearing their medicine bundles, and they've got items that have spiritual significance in those bundles. And when they're faced with something as traumatic as, you know, an infantry assault, they're calling upon those clan symbols and those clan figures to give them strength. And that's what these commanders are seeing, and they're misinterpreting it as, you know, just savage animal whoops and shrieks and such. It's really interesting stuff.
We hear from time to time about those Navajo code talkers in World War II. Some of us would be surprised to find out there were, what, Choctaw code talkers in World War I?
There were indeed 19 Choctaw code talkers in World War I that were sharing messages and military strategy over the telephones, which the Germans had wiretapped all through France. And because the Germans couldn't speak Choctaw, they were free to just communicate freely over the telephones, but in a code. So some of their messages were encrypted. They had words for a battalion. The Choctaw word was, they used the Choctaw word ear of corn. For a single unit, they used the Choctaw word for a kernel of corn. And so they're sharing these messages, but quite freely, and the Germans are listening in, but they don't know what they're hearing.
It's a little surprising that they're not better known.
No, and they were, well, they, because they were, you know, told not to talk about it because it was top secret. And so they didn't talk about it. A few did before they passed on. They covered a major retreat in the Meuse-Argonne forest campaigns. And it's their experience that really inspired the code talking of World War II. And the Marines looked at this, you know, the military history and said, well, we could do this with the Navajo. And so they put together this highly specialized, segregated unit of Navajo code talkers. But the Navajo aren't alone. There were dozens of tribes that provided code talking to all branches of service during World War II. And it's only now that Congress is looking at that service that many other tribes did and discussing battle honors that they're figuring to bestow on these men.
And what about the extent to which the infantry was integrated? You know, and what do we know about the relationships among the soldiers, the attitudes that the Native soldiers faced in terms of close living quarters and so
well,
on?
You know, it's really interesting because with African-American troops, with segregated units, you can follow their experiences through the war because there are histories of units and divisions and such. Because Indians are integrated into the units, their history is, you know, really, the transcript on their experience is really hidden. And so you kind of have to know geographically what units might have more Native soldiers in them based on where they were mustered out. So the 36th Division has more Native soldiers in it because of the geography, the 32nd, and units like the 45th Infantry, the Thunderbirds. That was a division that was put together largely from Native National Guard troops that were transformed into regular units from Oklahoma, New Mexico, Arizona, and Colorado. So we know that that, you know, was largely an Indian group. The Native soldiers who were integrated into white units, predominantly white units, what we find is bits and pieces here and there, and you really have to dig for it. But I did find descriptions from white commanders who had Native soldiers in their units who, you know, of course, said that they were all called chief. But you find that white soldiers who are interviewed about Indians say everybody felt safer if they had an Indian in their unit because, you know, there was the sense that, well, that guy knows what he's doing. So, you
for
know,
better or worse, yeah, huh?
That guy. And, you know, that guy might have grown up in a Philadelphia housing unit and never seen a gun, you know, and has absolutely no more experience than the white guys in the unit. But there's this perception that they're safer. And in some cases, there's some suggestion that they fought with more confidence and maybe were safer because of the perception. Mm-hmm. The perception became the reality.
What does the experience of Ira Hayes tell us about the experience of Native Americans in the military?
Well, it tells us that the Army had a pretty good public relations vehicle. My aunt used to say, never let the truth get in the way of a good story. You know, I don't know if you've seen Flags of Our Fathers,
yeah,
but that tends to be a more honest history of what happened, that perhaps he wasn't in the original contingent of flag raisers, but was in the contingent that was asked to restage that, to provide a photo opportunity. But his unit, three of the men who raised the flag were killed, and the others were quickly brought stateside because that photo became so, you know, iconographic, and Americans wanted to know about the men in – they wanted to know the personal stories of those men. And so he was brought back to help sell war bonds in the 7th War Bond Drive, and he was a Marine. He was in the front lines. I don't get the sense from any of the histories that I've read that he was necessarily being used as a shock troop member. But he saw some of the worst of the South Pacific campaign. And there were other soldiers who were used for publicity purposes as well. There's a memorable photograph of James Wapoose, a Menominee naval veteran who was used in a publicity photo by the Navy with a rifle and, again, a Plains war bonnet on, in the typical holding the rifle in one hand and the palm raised above the
right in the tradition of Calvin Coolidge.
Help me describe that because, you know, your listeners aren't going to be able to see my
shading,
little gesture.
Shading his eyes from the sun with his hand.
And, you know, looking off into the distance. There's that throughout various branches of service. Native Americans are being used to promote military recruitment. They're being used to sell war bonds. And it's almost as if the government is saying, see, if these guys are supporting the war effort after all we've done to them, then maybe you should too.
And the coping upon return, what is his story?
He was very uncomfortable being used in that way by the military, felt exploited. There were people that used his image in various representations. I know Joe Grandee painted a picture that is been reproduced a number of times where Ira Hayes is superimposed on this painted pony as this sort of glorious plains warrior with Mount Suribachi in the background. And, you know, he's a Pima. His people were corn farmers. They didn't come from a horse culture. And I'm sure that he felt the strain and stress of that. And he wound up sort of succumbing to alcoholism and died a pretty ignoble death in a ditch somewhere in his ancestral land. So it really is a very sad story, and one that is reproduced throughout the 20th century with a number of Native veterans. They don't cope very well and tend to medicate, you know, through alcohol and drugs, at least during the Vietnam era.
More on Native Americans in the military when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach. Our guest is Patty Lowe, and our subject for this conversation, The Way of the Warrior, Native Americans in the Military, not just a topic, but also the title of Patty Lowe's most recent television documentary. As long as we're on the subject of Native Americans' experience coming home from combat, and we've already mentioned Ira Hayes and how he had this really dismal result, what kind of support did these returnees get from the tribes, if not from the kind of standard social networks?
Well, you know, there are 564 tribes and things, you know, change from one. There's no uniform experience. But every Native community I visited in the production of this documentary had purification rituals for their returning veterans. And the Hopi ritually washed the hair of their returning veterans in yucca leaves. They gave them new names, which is very symbolic, almost as if to say, you know, that that person that you were who was trained to kill is not the person you're now. And so now you're a new person. And I remember the words that Michael Pavatia, who's the Veteran Services Director in Hopi, told me. He said, it's not just our obligation to that soldier to help him or her reintegrate, but it's also to protect the community because these people are bringing a poison back. And we need to deal with that both to help them and to protect the community. In the Plains cultures, there were victory dances and the telling of war deeds to a council of elders, which isn't so much as it's portrayed in bad B cowboy and Indian movies, you know, a boasting sort of thing. It really, to me, as I asked people about it, became better defined within the realm of group counseling. You know, tell
getting
us what
it
you
out.
Did.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's a cathartic sort of experience. Other tribes have sweat lodge ceremonies. My own tribe, for example, purifies returning veterans through sweat lodge ceremonies, which is a symbolic rebirth. So there were these ceremonies in place, and it may change from tribe to tribe, but all tribes recognize that it was an important part of that experience. Some of those rituals and ceremonies were illegal until the 1970s.
Just because of
the federal government
crackdown on
right, it wasn't you know the
India's difference.
Indian Religious Freedom Act wasn't passed until the early 1970s. So a lot of these were explicitly suppressed on reservations.
That seems hard to believe that you'd have somebody go off to war and then come back, and the purification or reentry ceremonies would then be illegal.
Right, some of them went underground, and some of them really died out. And in more contemporary times, they've been resurrected. But they, you know, they were there. And what Tom Holm found, who's a professor at the University of Arizona, who wrote a book, Strong Hearts, Wounded Spirits, about the experience of Vietnam Native vets, found was that returning vets who went back into communities that had these rituals and went through these ceremonies were much more likely to have more minimal symptoms of PTSD. And I think about that a lot now as I watch the television, the news on TV, and read newspapers and see these tens of thousands of veterans and or soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan who are coming back to us. And I don't hear anybody talking about how we're going to reintegrate these soldiers and deal with their emotional needs.
Anymore,
you know, they're coming back
done
scarred.
With Vietnam. Yeah.
Yeah.
So in a way, you're suggesting we could learn from
Absolutely.
These Native practices.
Absolutely. And, you know, it may take a different form, but I think we as a mainstream society need to recognize that there has to be some kind of reintegration process beyond just throwing money at a soldier and saying, here's, you know, a GI loan, go back to school, or here's some money to get a house or get some health care for the wounds that we can see. We need to have a structure in place to deal with their psychological wounds.
Well, the difficulty would strike me would be the difference between a veteran who's a member of one of these 540 tribes, which gives him or her the strong sense of identification and, if you want to say, extended family, whereas for, I would think, the vast majority of veterans, they wouldn't have that sense of identification with a support group that's not being paid
right.
in some professional context to help them.
I think that's true. But, you know, I've seen research on the value of initiation and ritual, you know, in service organizations. If you learn the secret handshake, if you get the ring, if you stand in a circle and hold hands or blow out a candle, you have a stronger identification with that group.
Yes, indeed.
You tend to be more loyal to it. And so certainly, you know, there are aspects of that in Native rituals and ceremonies. But I think the underlying psychological element is there. You know, there are parallels. And so whatever we come up with in terms of reintegration or reinitiation or some kind of group experience for these mainstream veterans, you know, I want to believe that it'll have some positive effect.
Yeah, we talk about the role that Native American women in the military played.
Yeah. Well, there were women in active duty in World War II. And actually, you know, it predates that. There's this great story about an Oneida woman during the American Revolution. You know, remember the Valley Forge and the 600 bushels of corn? That was arranged by George Washington's cook, a woman by the name of Polly Cooper, who, when her husband was wounded in the Battle of Oriskany, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right. It's one of those words that I've seen written, O-R-I-S-K-A-N-Y. Her husband was wounded in that battle. She picked up his musket and fought with the troops and then saved them at Valley Forge. So, you know, the experience, women warriors, and I'm sure it probably predates Columbus, but, you know, in a contemporary sense, there were Native women who served in active duty in World War II and Korea and Vietnam and today are serving in Iraq and Afghanistan. And if you'll recall, there was a lot of attention paid to Jessica Lynch, the
Yes.
Caucasian woman who was rescued from that Iraqi hospital. The woman that was killed in her unit was a Hopi woman, Lori Paiestewa.
Yes, that did
but
come out, yeah.
I'm sure that 99% of Americans wouldn't recognize her name, but most of them probably recognize Jessica Lynch's name.
Well, it's perhaps that same tradition of the PR vehicle mm-hmm. taking its own course for whatever reason.
Yeah, and that, you know, in a larger sense, that was part of my motivation for doing this documentary. You know, there were all these contributions. My goodness, more Native Americans received the Medal of Honor for their actions than any other ethnic or racial group per capita, but yet people don't know their names, they don't know their contributions, people don't mm-hmm. think about what their experience might have been in 20th century wars. And so this was an opportunity for me to not honor war. That absolutely was not my intention, to honor war in this documentary, but it was to honor the contributions of Native soldiers and to talk about their 20th century experiences and to look at 20th century history seen through the lens of Native soldiers.
How about one of those wars that even now seems to be overlooked, standing between Vietnam and World War II, and that's the Korean War.
Yeah.
You know, what was the Native American experience in the Korean War?
You know, the two stories that I tell in this documentary are really memorable ones. And to me, those two stories together are a metaphor for the experience of Native people in general in the 1950s. You have Mitchell Red Cloud, who was a decorated World War II soldier who reenlisted during the Korean conflict. He sacrifices himself, dies staging a one-man defense against holding off an entire army to give his unit time to stage a retreat and evacuate the wounded. And the military recognizes his contributions. They rename the combined headquarters in Korea, Camp Red Cloud. They name a battleship after him. He receives the Medal of Honor posthumously. And then you have his relative, you know, same tribe, same circumstances. He, too, dies heroically. It takes the army a year to send back his body. His widow, who's Caucasian, buys a plot in Sioux City Memorial Park Cemetery. The delegation comes over from Nebraska and sings him home and does a ceremony there. And his body is literally lying in, you know, in a casket above the open grave, and the cemetery official remarks to the funeral director, gee, there sure were a lot of Indians here. And the funeral director said, well, yeah, the deceased is a native hero. And the cemetery official says, well, he can't be buried here. You know, our charter of incorporation papers say this is a whites-only cemetery. And they call the family. The family has to take his body back to Nebraska. I mean, it was just absolutely obscene. And thankfully, Truman sends a telegram and tells the family, you know, apologizes on behalf of the whole nation and arranges for his body and the family to be flown back to Washington. They give him a hero's burial. We found film of it in the National Archives of this very stately funeral with the 21-gun salute and the riderless horse and the flag-draped caisson. But to me, those two stories epitomize life in the 1950s, where it's after World War II, there's this optimism that race is going to disappear. We're going to be this melting pot. We're going to be one color, and we're all going to live in the suburbs and little Levittowns. We're going to have washers and dryers. And so, you know, for the native people that are buying into this, and some are assimilating, they're mixed bloods, and they're able to pass as Southern Europeans, and they do start passing because they buy into this melting pot. And then these soldiers come home, they move to the cities, which is what the government is telling them to do, relocating them, terminating their tribes, and they're living they want to live the American dream, and they go to their movie theaters for Saturday matinees, and what do they see?
Indians getting shot off of horses.
Yeah. they see cowboys and Indians movies, and the military that they fought for in Korea or in Germany or France and during World War II. The very military that they sacrificed for, that they fought for, is shooting their people.
And a lot of those people are played by white guys,
and,
too.
They're not even making
a buck off the acting
And they're
job.
Watching their tribe, you know, a tribe by committee, you know, with Navajo leggings and, you know, Chippewa beaded vests, and they're on horses and wearing Plains war bonnets and these Indians drafted by committee. But it's their tribe that's being represented, and it's their tribe that's being killed by the U.S. military that they fought for.
It's so ironic. And when do you start finding in any of the documents or interviews that you collected, where do you start finding kind of murmurings of discontent, protests? Yeah. Sort of?
It's Vietnam. It's very clearly Vietnam. You know, World War II, I think it's starting. They're coming back. You know, they think life is going to get better, but it really doesn't. And then Korea, this is the period where, you know, if they assimilate, life will be better, but it's not. They're still getting discriminated against in jobs and housing and such. And Vietnam is where it really – it's been percolating, and here's where it bubbles up and over. And Northrop talks about it, and other Vietnam-era veterans talk about meeting Vietnamese people who come up to them and point to their skin color, their brown skin and their own brown skin, and say, you know, same-o, same-o. Holm writes about how Native men came back with a sense of themselves in a more – global context. They began making intellectual connections between their own lives and indigenous people around the world. And Northrop responds, I made the connection much earlier than that because I traveled around different countries and people would look at me and touch my skin and say, same, same, or point to my eyes and same, same, or what little bit of hair I had and say, same, same. This happened in Puerto Rico. It happened in Panama. It happened in Okinawa. It happened in Japan. It happened in Hong Kong. It happened in the Philippines. It happened in Vietnam. Everywhere I went, people thought I was one of them, and they'd start speaking the language like I was a native. I'd laugh at them and start speaking a few words in Ojibwe, and we'd start from there. And then he talks about baskets and, yes, you know, and making that connection. And a lot of veterans talked about that, you know, about starting to see their own indigeneity reflected in the indigeneity of the people in Southeast Asia. And they come home, you know, starting to make the connection, starting to see themselves in a more global context. And they go back to their communities. And the poverty and the despair and the dysfunction they saw before they left, they come home, nothing's changed. And their communities are starting to push them out, push them forward and say, well, you've been out there. You know what that U.S. government is like. You know, you can talk to these people. Go tell them. tell them, you know, what it's like here. And so, you know, veterans are really pushed forward by their communities. And it's not surprising that the American Indian Movement and Red Power starts in the cities, you know, where the government has begun to relocate Native people.
It starts in the
reservations where conditions are absolutely the worst, or at least it takes hold there. And it's veterans that are leading these organizations. You know, AIM,
yes.
Everybody in
the
leadership.
American Indian Movement, yes.
Veterans.
You have one vignette of a soldier who can't even get served a beer. Has that happened in Wisconsin?
That happened in Wisconsin. It was my uncle and with my grandfather. And my uncle still had his uniform on. And they were going up to northern Wisconsin to fish. And they'd been in the car for, you know, 6-8 hours and parched, just wanted to stop. It was just a watering hole on the way north and couldn't get served. And my uncle, he broke down after that and just sobbed in the interview. And I stopped it at that point because it was just, you know, too private and too painful to share that with the viewers. But my grandfather was humiliated. My uncle was humiliated. And I'll tell you, I've been in situations in this state and others within the last couple of years where I've gone in to a restaurant and don't get served, or the service is really lousy. And this, again, goes back to that perception is reality. And because I'm in a group of Native people, the question is always there under the surface. Are we not getting served because we're Indian, or are we not getting served because this place just has lousy service?
Right, yeah.
Where if I was in a Caucasian group of people and had the same experience, the assumption would be, well, I'm not getting served because, you know, the service is lousy here. There's not that question. And so perception really does become reality.
We'll hear more about the experiences of Native Americans in the military when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
Wisconsin Public Radio is online at WPR.org. It's a way to stay in touch. You'll find program information, news features, archived programs, and much more. Visit us anytime at WPR.org.
Oh, yeah, because my brothers were in service, and I felt that I was working toward protecting them. What little I was doing, I was trying to do the best I knew how. And it was imperative that I make everything match these specifications, little alterations in the blueprints from one to another. I made sure that it came out exactly right. I hadn't met my husband yet, but my older brother was in the Air Force, my brother-in-law was in the Air Force, and people that I knew were going in to serve, so I felt I was doing my part.
Those are the words of Alice Denomi Lowe, read by her daughter, Patty Lowe, describing working on torpedo beds during World War II. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Patty Lowe, whose documentary is called Way of the Warrior, and it is about the service of Native Americans in the military. What was surprising to you about doing this documentary? You mentioned that you set out to try to explore why Native Americans served in the military when they were treated so poorly so often in this country's history, that some of the reasons they joined were not what mm-hmm. you had expected. But what else did you run across that you hadn't necessarily planned to include?
The Creek community in Oklahoma was a really interesting place with some memorable people. As someone who minored in American Indian history, I had read about the Red Sticks before and had sort of filed them mentally in past tense, you know, on P for past. And for those who might not know much about the Red Sticks, this was a group of warriors, pre-Columbian, but in the American Revolutionary War periods and up through the War of 1812, they're fighting against the Americans, which is kind of why I guess I may have filed them under P for past ancient history. When I had interviewed Creek veterans over the phone and made arrangements to interview them in person, I get to Okmulgee and they walk in and they're all wearing red shirts and red sticks around their neck and baseball hats that have got Red Stick Warrior Society embroidered into the front.
New look, same old gang.
Yeah, you know, same song, second verse or continuous verse, or maybe the song never ended. But there's this real continuity, and they have a real sense of their history. And several of them talked about relatives who I actually was familiar with from Civil War history. One of them traced his lineage back to Osceola.
Osceola, a major figure, yes, in Florida in
absolutely,
the 1830s.
Absolutely. And other Civil War figures who fought for the Union against the Confederates, because the Civil War really split the Creek.
Indians fighting on both sides.
Yeah, right. And it was, you know, really interesting to me that they had a very clear sense of their history. And this was a contemporary expression of a traditional warrior society. You can even, you know, go to the web and Google Muskogee, you know, Red Stick Warriors, and their website will come up. The other thing that I thought was really interesting was I remember interviewing a fellow by the name of Doug Hawkins, who is a decorated medic in Vietnam and whose family had relocated to eastern Washington after World War II. His father went to work for the Hanford nuclear power plant there, and he was raised in an urban environment and came back to the reservation after the war. And I remember asking him, so, you know, tell me, when did you first learn about the Red Stick Warriors? And he, without blinking, he said, from Davy Crockett. I watched that Disney program in the 1950s and 60s, and I saw Red Sticks. He said, you know, and I'm rooting for Andrew Jackson. And then it wasn't until later that he started making the connections.
Wait a minute.
Something wrong there.
Right. You know, there's something wrong here. But he did say he remembered then, as he was talking to his parents about this and about this strange experience from the 1950s, having his sense of history sort of warped by and shaped by Disney, remembering that he had seen his uncle, who was one of the last of the World War II era Red Sticks, going through an initiation ritual where his uncle was made to run, and the members of the Warrior Society and the elders scraped his back with eagle claw talons to, you know, gently but ritually, but it was intended to strengthen him, and he was made to run again and again and again to build up his endurance. So, you know, this is something that is very much alive in Creek culture. Very structured. They have red towns and white towns, and the red towns are warrior towns. And there's a whole history there. I won't take that little spit off the main track here, but they're very aware of their military history, their warrior society,
so
their
warrior
traditions.
So they would be some of the first to sign up.
Absolutely. And what's really interesting, and they have not only a tribal tradition, but tremendous family traditions as witnessed by these warriors they're able to trace back, you know, to pre-revolutionary times. But also they willingly serve in the most dangerous positions. Again, tremendous incidents of men, Creek men, serving in the 82nd Airborne and 101st Airborne Divisions. They're the ones that are jumping behind enemy lines, scouting.
Yeah,
really
amazing.
Living the warrior image.
Mm-hmm. Were there moments when you were working on this film when it was overwhelming for you? You know, you mentioned that your uncle, you had to stop taping. And in this case, you've got the personal connection with relatives involved in the story that you're telling, as well as just sort of the sense of history. And I'm just curious at what point it became almost too much.
You know, there are so many contradictions, and I found myself really conflicted, especially looking at how Native soldiers disproportionately to this day serve in the most dangerous positions. And because they do, they disproportionately die. They disproportionately come home with higher levels, more severe symptoms of PTSD. And the promises of a better life not materializing, I found myself wondering, where does loyalty, where do tribal traditions and family traditions and clan obligations end, and where does exploitation begin? And it's clear, without passing judgment on the motivations, you know, of military enlistment among Native men, I do wonder why Native people continue to serve in such disproportionate numbers and why they continue to volunteer for, you know, to be Green Berets and Navy SEALs mm-hmm. and these really dangerous kinds of military jobs.
And why people don't know about it, I guess.
And why people don't know about it, yeah. But I have some philosophical issues that I haven't really dealt with and are my own issues. At the same time, I'm really proud of the military service that my own family members have provided. My intention with the documentary was to honor them. But just my own questions about war in general and the role of Native people in it, there's still a lot of unresolved issues in my own mind.
Is there writing coming out of any of these veterans?
Certainly out of Jim Northrop. Boy, is he prolific. And if you go to our website, www.wpt/wayofthewarrior, there's a link from our website to Jim Northrop's website so you can read other poems. He's got some tremendous poems. Some are funny, some are infuriating, some are they're just very thought-provoking.
Can you read the one that you included in the
Walking Point?
Yes, it's in the Wisconsin People and Ideas publication.
Yeah, this so perfectly spoke to the experience of Native men disproportionately serving in these dangerous positions. The Marine was walking light. He was hunting men who were hunting him. And apologies to Jim Northrop because he reads this, he recites this so much better than I can. And again, this is his poem, Jim Northrop. His rifle was in perfect order. He wasn't. Fear of not feeling fear. The heat, mud, and mosquitoes all addled his brain housing group as he walked and thought along. Thou shalt not kill. That stuff didn't work here. God must have stayed back in the real world. Is any of this real? Is this a green nightmare I'm going to wake up from? He sang to himself as his sense gathered evidence of continued existence. His eyes saw. His ears heard. His heart felt a numb nothing. His mind analyzed it all as he studied the trail. He amused himself as he walked along. The old story about bullets. Ha! Don't sweat the one that's got your name on it. Worry about the one addressed to whom it may concern. On another level, his mind churned with rifle, M14 caliber 7.62 millimeter gas-operated magazine lead air-cooled semi-automatic shoulder weapon, weight 12 pounds with 20 rounds, sustained rifle rate of fire 30 rounds per minute, effective range 460 meters, or hand grenade, M26, and so on and on and on. Movement. Something's moving up there. Dropped to the mud, rifle pointing at the unknown. Looks like two of them hunting him. They have rifles, but he saw them first. The Marine Corps takes over. Breathe, relax, aim, slack, squeeze. The shooting is over in 5 seconds. The shakes are over in a half hour. The memories are over. Never.
A great combination of the mundane and the extraordinary in that poem, Walking Point, by Jim Northrop.
Oh, he's such, you know, he's a fine poet. He's a playwright. He's a journalist. He has a syndicated column, Fond du Lac Follies. He's really an extraordinary man. And I think he's done a lot. He's written about those things that really resonate with Native veterans. And I know a lot of Native veterans take real encouragement from his writing.
Patty Lowe, congratulations on your newest film, and thank you for sharing it with us today, the topic of the Way of the Warrior. I'm Emily Auerbach with Norman Gilliland, hoping you can be with us for the next hour of University of the Air. Thank you.
next Sunday afternoon at 4 during University of the Air. Why would the very versatile artist Aaron Bolrod, in mid-career, suddenly devote himself to a single genre at the expense of all others? Some insights next Sunday afternoon at 4, right here on Wisconsin Public Radio.